Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It is October 30th, 2019. As always, I want to thank my donors. As some of you know, my divorce in 2014 cost me between $30,000 and $50,000. And that, of course, set me back for the years afterwards. Plus the simple fact that this kind of work is a full-time job, as I've said many times before. This is a highly specialized area. Anything political is specialized. Anything, any topic that you come across has thousands of books and papers in numerous languages published on at any given time. It would take a lifetime to get through even the most specific, obscure subfield you can imagine. And you know, the problem with amateurs, and amateurs always have a place because professionals can be idiots quite often. In academia, it's almost a job requirement. But amateurs are not specialists, and they usually don't know where to go for the proper information. And then if they did, they don't know how to analyze it. It is so easy to fall into both formal and informal fallacies. If you study the nature of fallacies and you have a very simple, you know, one sentence example, it seems stupid. You put that fallacy over a long argument, and it's almost impossible to detect. You go to grad school, everything you do is based on method. Its methodology is your entire focus. How to build an argument is extremely difficult. Building a real argument of any complexity is immensely time-consuming, if you're going to do it right. If you're going to avoid, you know, emotional appeals, capital letters, lots of exclamation marks, and you know, these the typical signs of amateurism. And one of the ultimate, most irritating signs of amateurism is using our postmodern vocabulary and priorities to analyze a society 500 years old, 1,000 years old. When you hear someone refer to Plato's view of civil rights, you have to start laughing. Again, amateurs have a place. Socrates' entire approach was to pretend to be an amateur and to show that the professionals, whether it be, you know, religious figures or generals or politicians, didn't know what they were talking about. Socrates never put forward a doctrine. At least the early Socrates didn't put forward a doctrine at all. All he did was ask inconvenient questions. That's where amateurs really can come into their own. That's, you know, the whole Socratic method is based on that. The claim that he didn't know anything meant that I'm just going to ask questions and see how you trip over yourself. Because of that, and because of the nature of academia, people like me are really up against it. And so, as always, I ask you to assist me in any way possible. As you see, I've been immensely busy. The Soviet experiment came out just a few months ago, and now my book on Ukrainian nationalism, has just come out a few days ago. In between those two, another book was released on the military dictators of Latin America. I now have 12 books out, I think. I could never remember. Now, this Ukraine book, which we're talking about now, was started really in 2012, if not before. The problem with that is because I often change my mind on minor issues, and sometimes not so minor, the book is often a history of how I thought about things over time. So, for example, I mention things about the Mongols in the traditional Asiatic assumptions about them. Well, if you listen to my show, you know that I don't believe they were Asian. There was no Mongol occupation of Russia in the sense of Mongolia, in the sense of Asia. That's a myth. Or Chernobyl is not what what we were told it was. But I do mention these things in the book because this stuff was written some time ago. And the other problem, I think I mentioned this before, is I don't include any of the recent developments in the church, which, of course, one of the things that's put Ukraine on the front page of the religious press. And not that what's been going on, not that the Patriarch of Constantinople is anyone to take seriously. That bishop hasn't been a serious contender since the Byzantine Empire. It's gotten worse over time, but it really can't shed the complete destruction that it suffered under the Turks. And we've talked about that at some length, especially when we dealt with a few years ago the so-called Philetist Synod in 1872, which of course was a robber synod, and I explained why that is. One of the problems with making the claim that 1054 is a significant date, which it was not, there was no moment where communion between Orthodoxy and the Roman Church was manifest. Nothing particular special happened in 1054. That's because the Patriarch of Constantinople is not a pope. He's barely a bishop of his own jurisdiction. Bishops are generally equal, and separate national and regional jurisdictions don't have to listen to anything he says. So claiming that 1054 meant that Orthodoxy wasn't in communion with Rome, old Rome that is to imply that the Patriarch is a pope, and he is no such thing. He wouldn't want you to believe that. But thank God, he is not. The separation of the churches is something that took place over a long period of time. It's absurd to think that, someone was saved in 1053 and damned in 1055. That's laughable. That's not how it works. If anything, the Gregorian reforms were really the period where the two churches began to separate radically. And the very latest you could take anything in Rome seriously as a church was, of course, 1204, for obvious reasons. But even that's probably too late. You have some very saintly Roman figures like St. Bruno, who are roughly in the late or very early 12th century era, who were anti-papal. You had many great figures in Rome that were anti-papal. These are just simple mistakes that people make. And that's why the situation with the Ukrainian church today doesn't interest me all that much. I do have a section in the book on Dmitry Yema and Patriarch Vladimir. They are very interesting people, especially Vladimir. But as far as very recent events, things that just happened really this year, I don't bother with, partially because I don't really care, and because the Patriarch of Constantinople gets way too much press as it is. He is, I don't believe he's a legitimate bishop. He can't be. He, this is a Masonic, deeply corrupt, ultra-liberal jurisdiction. The Pope has been readmitted to the diptychs in Constantinople and under Patriarch Demetrius. So technically there is no schism anymore. Again, you have to assume that he's a pope. His whole education, Bartholomew's education, was at Gregorium in Rome. So what he thinks and what he does isn't significant. And it doesn't matter anyway, because this is a book of history. And it takes the Ukrainian national idea essentially from Hetman Ivan Mazepa to roughly the end of the Cold War. And of course, I have a section on Donetsk and Eastern Ukraine, which I added at the last minute. So, you know, this is a long book. It's a very complicated book, because when you come to understand the national history of any specific group of people, you realize how complicated it really is. That you can't simply use a few slogans and apply it to a group of people and claim you know anything. Once you get deep into a group, you come to realize that there is no formula. You may have principles. That's not the same thing as an ideological, pseudo-intellectual set of labels that you apply to something that makes you sound smart, but in fact, you don't know anything. And even in this book, I can only touch on a few things. Every nation has its specific concerns and problems. And those specific concerns and problems are usually very complicated. To believe that you can just, use a couple of one-liners to describe them and move on means that you don't know how history works. And it's something that I have to talk about. You sound arrogant when you say it. I don't care how I sound, but it happens to be true. It's not to say that amateurs don't have a place. I just recently heard an amateur writer just tear apart an IRS agent over the tax issue in America. Now, I don't really know that much about that area, but he beat the guy. The IRS agent was stuttering and stumbling over his words. It was really a glorious thing. Somebody who's simply too comfortable in their position and doesn't hear a lot of opposition coming across a motivated man, it's often a great thing. Their role is to get professionals to realize that they are way too comfortable. Now, in academia, it's a different story, because even a more ignorant amateur is probably better off than your typical university professor. They don't really know what we think about things. All they know is caricature and mockery and comedy. And they actually think they know something, but we know them in great detail. And that's why we tend to win arguments. That's why they have speech codes. I've said this many times before. A new professor, a white male professor, knows that he's in a lot of trouble already just by being a white male. He's automatically under suspicion. Female professors rule without mercy. They're promoted without any reference to knowledge or ability. I've seen it happen. Personally, I've confronted them on this with disastrous results, but I had to do it. And so what they tend to do for that six-year period before they get tenure is they overcompensate. So they become the most radical anti-sexist, anti-racist person on campus, with the assumption that eventually, they'll be beyond suspicion. This often backfires, and they sound stupid. I think over time they come to believe this nonsense because the job is an amazing one. The job is very easy. It's very prestigious. The money is great. There's not much work. And you have a captive audience. And you get a lot of attention. Not to mention summer's off. It's really a tremendous environment. And one of my great sadness in this life is that I'm pretty much banned from the university, despite the fact that the university really is the only place I feel comfortable, despite what's gone on. The environment is geared towards me. I still think in terms of semesters, And it's really heartbreaking. I was very, very good at what I did. And watching complete idiots get tenure based on either gender issues or strictly personal concerns, really is a tragedy, and students suffer. A college education, at least in my field, is absolutely meaningless because with your typical professor. Now, and this is why, of course, I ask for money, as distasteful as it is, because I have no other source of funding, and because this is most certainly a full-time job. This is where that donation money goes. To do these translations, to study this stuff in depth because I know where to go. And today I want to talk about two people who don't get talked about very much. They're what you might vaguely call national anarchists. In Ukraine has produced a lot of them. Mykhailo Kostomarov and Mikhail Drahomanov. These are very interesting, rarely discussed nationalist writers that, you know, are not your typical, you know, again, the thesis of this book is that Ukrainian nationalism is legitimate and it needn't be anti-Russian. Remember, fighting against the Petrian state in St. Petersburg is not the same thing as fighting Russia. Petersburg was designed as a non-Russian city. It was to turn the Muscovite Third Rome into just another European empire. And of course, the war against the USSR conflated Soviet imperialism with Russian imperialism. And they use the term, and Ukrainians do this all the time, they use the term Russian very loosely. They use the misnomer Soviet Russian. That's kind of a Ukrainian thing to say. Well, Russian culture and religion was banned in the USSR. So being opposed, as Ivan Mazepa was, and Mazepa was absolutely correct, to fight the almost psychotic Peter the Great and to go to the Swedes for assistance, it ended disastrously, but he couldn't possibly have known that. Peter's revenge against Ukraine was brutal. Remember, by the time Peter died, the population of Russia went down about 10%. The church had been entirely purged. Every bishop had been replaced. And putting, people like Feofan Prokopovich in charge, the man was a materialist. Sometimes he was a Lutheran. He was a Uniat most of his life. Ultimately, he didn't care. He was concerned with power. Peter the Great put bishops on the rack. Look up what the rack was. And he did some of this stuff personally. He tortured them to death. Even Lenin didn't do that. Certainly not personally. There was no, using strict canonical rules, by the time Peter died, and of course the whore, and she actually was a whore, so-called Catherine I, who I have more of a claim to be a Russian monarch than she does, was meant to be a mockery of the tsardom. And of course, it wasn't a tsar anymore, it was an emperor. There was no legitimacy there at all. And these bishops were uncanonically imposed by Prokopovich and Peter. And that's just the Petrian era. And it got worse under the Masons, the two Annas, where you have a Masonic clique from Germany who was running the country, who was determined to destroy Orthodoxy. Russian nationalists have not dealt with these issues yet, not even in Russia. I deal with these issues. The 18th century was a dark, dark time where the old Russia was destroyed long before the Soviet Union. The difference being, of course, that 18th century rulers didn't have the technological apparatus that 20th century rulers did. And of course, Catherine the Great purged yet again. There's an entire set of new martyrs, as I call them, new martyrs to the Petrian yoke, that again, no one is dealing, even despite the fact that people like Arseniy Matveyevich have been canonized, who was murdered by Catherine the Great, I said this before, in the worst possible way. I can't imagine a worse torture than this. He was thrown into a little room the size of a closet forever. I mean, the man had to have probably smashed his own head in. No one was allowed to know who he was. They had a fake name. I'd rather just cut my head off than just shove me in a room that I could never leave. And it was the worst way to die. No one's quite sure how long it took. I've written on him before. It's absolutely heartbreaking what they did to this very, very holy bishop. And this is nothing new. This is, you know, they did this to many, legitimate bishops. One of the things that St. Arseniy did when he got to Ukraine to take his see is note that the church didn't exist there. It had been completely wiped out. You had no functional parishes. Many of the monastics had fled to Slavic parts of Austria, which is where the Manjavaski comes from. And really the only real Orthodox tradition you had was maintained by the old believers. And it's on that basis that I've always been a firm supporter of the old belief. The jurisdiction I'm a part of now has a strong component of the old believers within them. The abbot here that I answer to is an old believer, for example. And of course, they venerate, you know, Nicholas II, all that stuff. They're not, you know, the extreme priestless types by any means. But this group is, has a strong element anyway of the old belief in them, which makes me feel very, very comfortable. Ukrainians always had a very strong, devotion to the old belief. This is where many of the old believers fled, and the Cossack forces were almost exclusively old believers, in the 18th century and beyond. And if they're not old believers, they're part of the true Orthodox Church. This is where the Cossacks have gone, and this is why you don't hear a lot about them, even in the Russian press so much. And the Cossack idea has strong national anarchist and religious anarchist elements to it. Remember, anarchism traditionally doesn't mean chaos. Those two words are not synonymous in any way. Anarchy refers to authority rather than power. That coercion isn't necessary in a tightly knit family. And if it is necessary, it's done collectively. Power and authority are very different things. Power is simply the ability to coerce somebody. The mafia has power. Drug dealers have power. But they don't necessarily have authority. Authority is the right to use power. That's a separate issue altogether. So, one of the specific elements I love about Ukrainian thinking is that thought is ultimately a social matter. Shevchenko and Franco make that the absolute foundation of everything that they do. Nikolai Kostomarov is based on the simple thesis that philosophy is never idle. It's not abstract theorizing. It derives from social problems and takes its shape based on the local issues which form its context. Therefore, true philosophy is national as a result. Even Plato said so. Outside of Greece, they were barbarians. Since a nation provides a language for all thought, and thought is bound by language, philosophy itself must, to a great extent, be national. Now remember, that does not contradict the idea of universalism. There are universal natural laws. No one believes that gravity is national. And of course, if natural law applies in the external nature, then it certainly applies to human nature too. Natural law does exist. The truth of the faith are universal. But in and of themselves, they're way too abstract to matter. They have to take, and I'm talking about natural law here, and canon law here, they have to take a national form because they have to be communicated and understood in a specific language. Kostomarov's philosophy of history is ethnically based. Three civilizations that form Europe in his understanding was, of course, the Israelites. Old Testament, we're not talking about Jews. Very different group of people. Israelites, the Greco-Roman world, of course, and then the Slavs. And that there, that civilization made a specifically religious contribution to European life. The Israelites were a people chosen by God. Now, the problem in the Old Testament is that they spent most of their time being apostates, that being God's chosen was far too much for them. Now, after Christ's murder, they simply eliminated God and put themselves in his place. But in the Old Testament, they're always being invaded and attacked and criticized and verbally assaulted by the prophets. Very few people bother to read these guys. They make all of these claims about the Old Testament being too harsh and too violent. They wouldn't know Elijah from Jeremiah. The prophets spoke over and over again about God's punishment on the Israelite race. And of course, the temple's destroyed altogether because of the Pharisaical establishment that didn't recognize Yahweh in the flesh, which was Christ. In rejecting Christ, they broke permanently the relationship between themselves and God. In rejecting Logos, God's expression, they developed a distorted idea of nature based on Babylonian alchemy, which became modern science. It's from the rejection of Logos that's led to the amoral revolutionary nature of what we call Judaism today, the Kabbalah. In Eric Vogelin's sense, the Jews became the very principle of Gnosticism, the desire to overthrow or recreate the order of being, the order of nature. Then the Greco-Roman idea. Now, I don't like broad, sweeping characterizations. Even Hegel's philosophy of history, as brilliant as these guys are, I don't like, and think, you know, Spengler, even a genius like Eric Vogelin, broad, sweeping, one-two-line summary of an entire civilization are almost always wrong. You can't do it. It's like trying to summarize your life in one or two sentences. It's wildly overgeneralizing. Unfortunately, that's inherent in any kind of philosophy of history. But in Customato's mind, the Greco-Roman civilization failed because it never developed the idea of a true communal liberty. There's always this confrontation with the community or the state on the one hand and the person or the family on the other. The Roman concern with bureaucratic politics forced the Roman idea to reject God and eventually Christ and the Roman papacy. They're abstractions. They're extreme ethnic forms. It's similar to his own view on Poles versus the Russians. Each people, regardless of any, you know, level of variation, they do show general markers of behavior that are historically conditioned. The monotheism of the early Israelites and the legal mind of Rome are certainly not exhaustive of these people, but they definitely show and point to a general emphasis in terms of behavior that derived from their historical world. That the Romans were very much legally oriented is a true statement. But that doesn't explain their politics at all. It is something that you see over and over again and is one of their contributions to the world. It's not so much to say that the Romans were purely abstract legalists, but rather that the law developed to a great extent and to a systematic extent under and within the empire, not just Western Rome, but Eastern Rome too. Then finally, the Slavs, who themselves, in Customato's mind, became the chosen people of God. The chosen people concept doesn't provide any reason for gloating, you can't consider yourselves better than anybody else. Your life just gets harder because the standards are far greater. This is the problem. The Third Rome idea simply meant that the standards that Muscovites had to adhere to were far greater than anybody else. That's a crushing responsibility to have the idea of the Christianized Rome on your shoulders. And this is a problem I have when religious people fail and fall and sin. People with no standards criticize those who have impossibly high standards, which is ridiculous. Having no standards mean you have nothing to say about people who fail for having very, very high standards. For Customato, the specific contribution of the Slavic world was the proper love of God or understanding of God within a context of a free rather than bureaucratic society, institutions. Ukraine represents the Second Jerusalem, which is not a response to the Third Rome, but actually Second Jerusalem is older than that. And avoiding the persistent Roman pitfalls of almost the veneration of the state and bureaucracy, which you see in the Roman papacy. But Ukraine, in his mind, was a synthesis of Greco-Roman and Orthodox worship. Greco-Roman in both Western and Eastern forms. I've written on the doctrine of Sabona Pravna for a very long time. It's the Ukrainian analog to Sobornos. It's, in his mind, really the final expression of the unfolding of the church on earth. Now, in practice, I mean, oftentimes you see that word being used in Ukrainian contexts, and they say stupid things. That Sabonoplavna, Pravna means the rule of the council. No, there's nothing special about the council. It can be the manifestation of the truth, but they certainly err all the time. It's the assembly of a spiritually healthy people. What makes them spiritually healthy? You're almost tempted to say that Rousseau's general will remains almost the formal essence of Sabonoplavna. Because even Rousseau said that the general will isn't found as a result of mere voting, but it's a recognition of the truth. Just as an aside, Rousseau has been so wildly misunderstood. You have historians today who will tell you that Rousseau is one of the inspirations behind the French Revolution. That's a ridiculous statement. It's almost as stupid as saying that nationalism starts during the French Revolution, despite the fact that that revolution was purely individualist and bourgeois, the very opposite of those things. Rousseau was an anti-modernist. His first essay that he won an award for as a much younger man was claiming that technically, and this is in, you know, the 18th century, that technological progress and scientific progress has no relation to moral progress. In fact, it may have an inverse relation to it. And he never left that idea. He was a revolutionary with the state of nature nonsense. The state of nature was a revolutionary concept. It almost was a thought experiment, a hypothetical revolutionary situation where you start from zero, which of course is impossible. There was never any state of nature. And so even using it as a hypothetical doesn't make any sense. But Rousseau couldn't possibly have been the origin of the French Revolution, because the French Revolution was the apogee of modernism. And Rousseau vehemently condemned it. He condemned individualism. He condemned what we call today bourgeois rights. Nothing that came out of the French Revolution could be found in Rousseau. In fact, they were at war with each other. This is what happens when people don't read these guys. And they hear a slogan, they read a slogan in a book, they hear it in a podcast, and they start repeating it. Over time, it becomes the truth that everyone knows is true. And it never is. Anyway, Sabonoplavna can be found to some extent in the idea that general will is the truth, manifest, even not explicitly, but in almost the subconscious of a people. This is what makes them healthy. You know, when people act, generally speaking, they don't go through this philosophical discussion before they can make sense out of their action. They just do. Very rarely do we have to go through and agonize over a decision. Most of our decisions are made instinctively. Now, of course, today, the subconscious is twisted, and the default settings that people go on are inhuman. So the general will is impossible today. But he makes it very clear that even if there's total unanimous vote, that still is not the general will. The general will is a Platonic form. It can be found in a people, and it certainly has to take a national form because the nation is based on language, language in a very broad sense of the term. So the folk assembly, in the Ukrainian sense, vivified by centuries of oppression, suffering, resistance, can achieve the task of recognizing Logos as the wisdom of the Father, present in both nature and history. The folk assembly for Kostomarov is the receptacle of the general will. The prince has a function, but only as the executor of that will. And really, a monarchist really doesn't have much to say about that, because a prince certainly can't function outside of natural law. If natural law is the nature of the general will, then it would follow that the assembly is based on that, therefore the actions of the monarch are based on that. The difference, of course, is that the prince has to make very specific decisions, militarily or whatever, that require a very different kind of a mind. Remember, at the time, the notion of the prince, of political rule, was as a military leader. That's what justified royal rule at the time is the man who can lead armies into battle and be victorious. Even today, there's nothing that will destroy an idea more completely than a lost war. So the ideal state for Kostomarov is based on the idea of election, but not in the sense we use the term. Parliamentarism and democracy not only are not connected, but they're opposites. Parliamentarism is an oligarchic institution. You know, we're not talking a representation and liberal democracy like we talk about today usually have nothing to do with each other. But it is a perpetual expression of the general will in choosing various elements that will rule society in public areas where generally agreement is required. Both Rousseau and Kostomarov hold that the general will is not the will of all, and certainly not the democratic majority. It's what the society as a public thing has in common with all of its members. Elections are the presence of the general will in Rousseau's sense, not some whoring for votes, financial support, but in realizing the truth in any given moment, where liberal democracy rejects the concept of truth as such. The type of government, the specific nature of these institutions, can't be set in stone. They differ depending on the circumstances of a people. Now, those circumstances is what matters, and people use that phrase all the time without ever digging into what that might mean. I have a book out on Alistair McIntyre, the pet token conservative of academic philosophy. And he spent book after book talking about traditions and customs without ever mentioning a single one. He never talks about what specific customs, but where can this be applied? Is he talking about medieval France? Is he talking about 19th century Germany? He never says it. These are simple abstractions. And so you could read whatever you want into these abstractions. So people will read him, thinking that they're seeing, the, you know, reading this conservative scholar, and it's an act. Because he never refers to any specific society, these are just words. Now, for Kostomarov, Russia required a basically centralized monarch to deal with the constant, you know, threats from the outside. Poles, Austrians, Prussians, Swedes, Lithuanians, Tartars. And of course, in the Middle Ages, these slave-driving hordes coming from the southern mountains. The Russian state required a strong monarch, a strong, coherent law code, and the constant integration of the spiritual and the political in terms of power for the sake of unity and social discipline. Now, most societies require that. But Russia required it to a very great extent. I've said this many times, I've been saying this since grad school, that because much of Russia has such a harsh climate, the agricultural growing season is so short, a great amount of discipline and communitarianism has to exist in order for the society to function. Ukraine, having a beautiful soil, developed more of a yeoman-style farming method. I mean, they have communes too, but the nature of the soil and the much nicer climate makes, you know, Ukrainian development, even apart from its own history, by itself, shows how this is going to be two very different societies. Federalism for Ukraine is now the second element of the ideal state. Federalism is the expression of the general will because it requires the public to be physically close to the centers of power. The problem with St. Petersburg, well, one of the many problems, is it was very distant. Very few people can actually get there. It took a long time to get there. It was a harsh trip to get there. It was a parody of justice. It was almost designed to create this alienated, separated professional bureaucracy that has very little contact with the common people. Now, remember, the bureaucracy in the Russian Empire was very small compared to France or Britain. Per capita, civil servants is about a tenth of what you have. You know, in the 19th century, Paris had more bureaucrats than Petersburg did. But the folk assembly is the act of element. Federalism and regionalism are the same thing, based on, you know, the simple principle that different areas of Ukraine, like the south, is always very exposed. East and West require different governing structures. Trade, currency, law should be singular and central. is to say that despite the interest in federalism, those three elements have to be the same. Law can't affect one class differently from another. He did believe in free trade, but made it clear that currency needs to be under state control and very stable. The Russian ruble under the Tsar had the same value in 1700 as it did in 1900. Now, the only purpose for a centralized state is for rapid and effective self-defense. While laws in their general constitutional form are the same for everybody, the specific manifestations of that idea will differ from region to region. David Sander wrote a very well-written article on Kostomarov, and he explains the basic philosophy of history here. History is moving towards the spiritual sovereignty of all ethnic peoples as a global phenomenon. Then history is moving towards the idea of the general will manifest in separate nations as a global phenomenon, you know, as an international phenomenon. Nationalists are the only real internationalists because we recognize and respect the national interests of others. Imperialism and nationalism are opposites. Imperialism is only a problem because it crushes other functioning nations. If nations don't exist, then imperialism doesn't exist. Solidarity and a non-statist agrarian socialism in the communitarian sense like you had in Russia is the best constitution, although it always takes different forms. Remember, the word constitution simply means the law in its most universal and rudimentary form. It doesn't mean something on a piece of paper. But the rise of nationalism was a death knell for empires. A strong nation, unified and under strict moral discipline, is stronger than any empire. And part of the reason for that is that a free nation, men are fighting for their hearth, home, for their wives and children. In an empire, generally speaking, soldiers are forced to fight. An empire is based on coercion, while a nation, in its ethnic and religious sense, is based on solidarity and authority. Now, empires differ just like countries do. But you can't use metaphors that we, for example, in our modern sense, refer to countries, don't apply to empires. In the Russian Empire, for example, the way that Washington, D.C. relates to Miami is not how St. Petersburg related to Kiev. Those are very, very different. Or Poland or Finland. They had their own institutions. Finland and Poland had their own constitutions. And you didn't have much interference. An empire is a collection of nations that find it in their interest to cooperate rather than fight one another. Problems develop, like in the Austrian Empire, where these nations are very different from one another. Now, Kostomarov, who was a former serf, like Shevchenko was, saw Ukraine as a symbol of the world's underclass, a misunderstood, and they certainly are, and an oppressed group of people that elites have co-opted, leaving an isolated and suffering agrarian class very easily demonized and mocked. The very familiar claim in the 19th century was that Ukrainian was a peasant language, meant that it was a language for the ignorant, not for the westernizing cosmopolitans of St. Petersburg. And slogans like that, you see, you know, where do things like white trash come from in the West? These slogans are designed to justify the exploitation of these people. Ukraine was terribly exploited. Ukraine gave more than it got. Wealth was extracted from Ukraine and spent elsewhere. And that was the case in the Petersburg era as well as in the USSR. Without Ukraine, these countries would not have been successful. Throughout the world, the self-serving belief that the agricultural classes are simpletons and ignorant, that exists primarily to justify their continual exploitation by urban elites. They are not. And when you have a national, I mean, most national ideas are peasant ideas, in the sense that they're rural, except possibly the Hungarian, I don't know. But the national ideas, certainly in places like Serbia and Ukraine, have been very agrarian. Kostomanov was generally pro-Russian. He was a relatively rare specimen who justified Russian intervention in Ukrainian affairs. And first of all, the existence of the Uniate Church, which was the Polish Catholic Church, led to the denationalization of the country under Polish rule. And of course, as I've dealt with some time ago, Hetman Doroshenko made a deal with the Turks to bring a Turkish army in, and they ended up, really destroying the place. I mean, even Mazepa was a failure, since he was defeated after he sided with Sweden. So after those experiences, joining with Russia doesn't seem all that bad. And for all of its problems, I mean, remember, even the most pro-Russian hetmans ended up turning on Russia because the exploitation got too great. They pushed too hard. Kostomanov and Drahomanov were absolutely the essential point is that the folk assembly is based on folk ideas in developing this general will. It's a complex idea. So Bonapravna is about the folk expressing itself over the centuries. And you could see this in folk songs, in popular ballads. And over time, you put all this together, and it looks like a political program of some kind. That's not all it is. You can't extract political theory in a complete sense from it. But the general will is best understood by looking at the basic structure of folk poetry, which is why Kostomanov spent so much time studying this stuff. And remember, at the time, folk poetry was not taken seriously. One of the things the 19th century developed was the realization, even Johann Herder in Germany in the 18th century, was that folk poetry has a tremendous amount of wisdom to it. They're closer to their natural law. Urban elites are too alienated and too corrupt for it. And the only reason it was denigrated was so they can be more easily exploited. So Kostomanov, put together one of the best known typologies of Ukrainian history. The Genesis of the Ukrainian People was his work, which is a landmark in Slavic history. He talked about the development of the Cossack host was due to the misrule of feudal elites, especially the imposition of serfdom upon a free people. And the Slavic unity, and even religious unity, is based on the lay element, with the Cossacks, the brotherhoods, the communes. And of course, the Christian faith is the center of ethnic unity. The host, Ukraine, Lithuania, Poland, they're all Christian nations in one form or another. And he did believe in a pan-Slavic idea. Well, the problem with this is that you have very different nations coming together. The big problem I have with Kostomanov is the notion that, Poland and Ukraine can never work together. They've been enemies for many centuries, and that is not going to change. And even if they weren't, the Roman Catholic world on the one hand and the Orthodox world on the other, especially in the Ukrainian context, creates two very different groups of people. And he even has a sacred history here. And he argues that after the expulsion from Eden, men gradually forgot about God. That man became fragmented, earthbound. That he just developed a utilitarian view of the world and really forgot about God. That the gods of the ancient world are really fashioned from the Titans. And the Titans are just a metaphor for those with earthly power. We use that phrase all the time, the titans of industry. A giant isn't necessarily a big guy. It's someone who's metaphorically big. These are people, but the powerful, those with money, act pretty much the same way gods were thought to act. But they're titans in that they force order on chaos. It might not be a great order, but it's not chaos. And the greater class rule exists in a society, the more divisions will be found. The more divisions that are found, the more that manipulation and Machiavellian methods have to be used to hold it together. And the coming of Christ was about reconnecting the lost soul, the nominalist, utilitarian, earthbound man to something that they hadn't known in a long time, and that's the divine. And each nation has a specific calling in this respect. Kostomanov and Drahomanov see the ethno-federalism, the model on the Cossack coast, which is distinctive to Ukraine, but you can find this elsewhere. The strength of the Cossack coast is one of the things that makes Ukrainian political theory different from elsewhere. On the steppe, there is a rough equality, but in order for that to exist, there has to be strong communal structures. And those communal structures are based on constant warfare with the outside. And for them, it's the noble classes, not the royal. It's the noble classes that stand in the way. That Ivan III, Basil III, and Ivan IV, Ivan the Terrible, were for them very strongly positive. We're talking about Muscovite Russia here, not Petersburg. Russia was well organized because the strength of the crown could overwhelm the oligarchs. Now, there were plenty of good nobles. Every society needs them. Nobles were the alternative to bureaucracy. But the local and tribal democracy never died out. And really, the Duma is not a parliament, but the Duma was a throwback to the old tribal divisions. Kostomanov, it doesn't disagree. As the Golden Horde began to fall apart, on the one hand, local freedoms began to develop and they became essential to the Muscovite period on the other. So since Ukraine doesn't have a noble class inherently, she was spared this parasitic growth. And that's something very positive. Federalism should be the representative agency for all regions. It's absolutely crucial. And can the local Duma run the society rather than a distant centralized system? Bureaucracy, Kostomanov, is a continuation of the noble misrule of the Slavic world. One of the reasons that the Cossacks exist in the first place. And Ukraine's mission, and the mission of nationalism, is to challenge it. Kostomanov has several, really four basic elements in the idea of the folk that makes sense out of all of this. Orthodoxy in the folk poems centers around Christ's suffering, and it makes sense. People under foreign rule are always suffering. Christ's suffering then makes a lot more sense because they often can experience it. God is in control, therefore suffering comes from him. That doesn't mean that God's immoral or evil, but that rather that suffering exists for a greater good. If understood correctly, it's never meaningless. It creates a purified society, a purified person, a society capable of independence and moral solidarity. Without suffering, nothing good happens. Nothing worthwhile in our lives is painless. One of the essential symbols of Ukraine is the Mother of God, especially the Holy Protection. In the old sense, it represents Ukraine's fertility and the connection among national ideas, the peasantry and logos. Ukraine is a mother to her children, which, like for Shevchenko, was a theme of great importance. It implies that the family remains the basic unit of society, and by that they mean the extended family, and the social institutions are an extension of the family unit. Nations are natural. They're as natural as families are, as families aren't big enough to be self-sufficient. And they come into existence because we live in a hostile world. And fighting external elements, we develop these defense mechanisms that assist us in our self-preservation. And then once that comes to exist, intermarriage within that group of people becomes more common. And then that leads to a nation with very specific physical, linguistic characteristics. But all of this is natural. This is wisdom. This is logos to be found in God's creation. There's no difference between a nation and any other natural form. Birds, for example, play a very great role in Ukrainian folk poetry. The image of the hawk often represents the bureaucracy, Petrine Russia, while the nightingale represents freedom, communal freedom. And there's an old myth, that the peasantry is neither political nor national, and it's just academic, liberal, wishful thinking. Ukraine, the folk songs and art are very ethnic and very national. They're deeply historical. And the Cossacks play a very strong role in folk thought. They're an embodiment of the national and ethno-religious idea. The two people that are hated in folk poetry are Turks and the Jews, the enemies of Christ, the enemies of Slavdom, and the enemies of justice. Sometimes there'll be something anti-Russian, but usually only in the Petrine era. But because they're an Orthodox people, it's rare to find blatant attacks on them. The non-Orthodox are the most obnoxious enemies. That gives them an extra excuse to destroy Ukraine. The Cossacks are an order of knights. It is the apogee of Orthodox chivalry. They're knights in the true sense. They're not afraid of death. They care only for the good of Ukraine and the Orthodox people. You have to be Orthodox to be a member of the Cossack host. The family, both as an organic reality and as a metaphor, is absolutely essential. And of course, it's connected to the idea of the nation, since the nation is seen as an extended family with biological roots. And then womanhood. And I mean woman before the second half of the 20th century, where it became a perversion and almost a mockery of womanhood, one of Satan's great victories. Woman, like you see in Nikolai Gogol, is the nurturer of the nation, a symbol for the fertility of the soil. Woman is the metaphor for these expanding circles of family, clan, village, nation. They're natural outgrowths of the simple family unit. Logos manifests itself in biology. It shows, you know, the outline of nature and justice. For the folk poets, death is always better than occupation or slavery. Death is not necessarily a bad thing. It's a sign of heroism, fraternity, glory, self-sacrifice. And for the real hero, of course, heaven is essentially martyrdom. So heaven is automatic and without question. So the four elements then, the Cossacks, woman, the family, and the peasantry. These are the things that are absolutely essential, you know, in Kostomata's world, as well as Ukrainian nationalism in general. What makes Ukrainian nationalism not so much distinctive, but the way that they manifest this in their writing, and of course what holds them all together, is ethno-nationalism is identical with local orthodoxy. If there's any Orthodox church that vehemently condemns that so-called philotism nonsense, it's the Ukrainians. Because they'll say over and over again, there is no such thing as a generic Orthodox man. Just like there is no generic man. In the folk idea, there's nothing more comprehensive and omnipresent as that idea. The family is the center of all life and the potent symbol of womanhood. And the Ukrainian nation and its Cossack protectors are an extension of the same idea. Political issues at the folk level are really family squabbles. Folk poetry of Ukraine seeks the defense of motherhood because it's so absolutely essential. Shevchenko, for example, centers most of his work around the idea of motherhood. Mercy over law, solidarity over ego, security and warmth over rationalism. The Brotherhoods had a tremendous impact on Slavic and Ukrainian ideas. The Brotherhood is a fifth element. It's a Slavic federation based on ethnic and a non-statist unity. It's essential to Svobodoprav. When the Patriarch of Jerusalem, in the 17th century, came to consecrate a new hierarchy for Ukraine, the Brotherhoods were given episcopal status, which is something that exists in no other country. So Brotherhoods actually have the status of a ruling bishop. Now remember, as we know, bishops aren't individuals. It's an office, and it's a communal office. It's the sobor of the diocese. There is no individual who rules because individuals don't exist. It's the rule of the local community and its tradition. Of course, to be a tradition, it has to be connected with natural law. It can't be just anything. Abstractly, it's about building justice freedom and equality through the Christian virtues, equality in the sense of equity. For the Brotherhood, Ukraine was a good position to show the world how to rise up from serfdom and then promote an anti-colonialist nationalism, so central to Ukrainian social thinking. The Brotherhood associated Freemasonry with the entrenchment of oligarchy, especially the arrogance of the urban, often foreign forces against the peasantry. The Christian virtues to be developed in opposition to usury centered around the solidarity brought about by linguistic unity in the broad cultural sense of the term. So independence, in other words, is to be brought about and can only make sense through ethnic solidarity, which for them, and for me, is the only realistic source of political unity and identification. In fact, it is political unity and identification. So the Slavic Federation would rise from the bottom up. Each ethnic group or each region was to maintain her own borders, and all forms of imperialism, economic or political, were condemned. Now that's, I think, a ridiculous idea. A pan-Slavic idea doesn't work. One country's going to be more powerful than another, and they're going to eventually be resented. But I understand where it comes from. Of course, there has to be cooperation. Of course, there has to be friendship. But where you're united in something other than independent states, the stronger are always going to push too hard, even if their intentions are good. But still, it's a humane form of nationalism that treated the state as a necessary evil. The ethnic group, the family, this is where power was to be found. Solidarity does have coercive force, but not in the same sense that the state does. And the agrarian connection of it all in the Brotherhood is essential to it. The kind of agrarian and communal equality becomes Ukraine's contribution to the new European order of independent, strong, and proud national societies. The singular virtue governing relations among ethnic communities was mutual respect. The famous membership of the Brotherhood that was founded by, now I'm using Brotherhood in more than one sense, he created his own political group. The Brotherhood, which included people like Shevchenko and Drahomanov, sought a recreation of the Greek polis, the city-state, it's kind of face-to-face democracy in the true sense of the word, based on Tvonopravna, not the parliamentarist Republican oligarchy. The Brotherhood that he created didn't last very long, only lasted 18 months, but it's not the religious institution that I mentioned from Patriarch Theophanes III, but it does have its foundation there. Remember, people guys like Gulak and others, it was a paternal kind of authority. So that's just a piece of what I deal with in this book on Kostomanov, and I didn't get to Drahomanov at all, as is normally the case, but these guys are very complex, and very few people talk about them. And what they have to offer, and it goes, if you read them, and there are English translations of most of their stuff out there, it's extremely enlightening and very interesting. In fact, reading some of the Ukrainian national writers, whether they be the Federalist types or the agrarian types, whatever they might be, often changes your political view forever. Anyway, my book on Ukraine is out on Amazon. It's simply called Ukrainian Nationalism. The Kindle, there's every edition you could think of. There, of course, the hard copy edition is available. I thank you for donating to me and assisting me. Whether you buy the book or not, I appreciate your support over the years. Thank you very much. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.